glucose and other things present, it stimulates them to start making fat.
The media hype around the G-spot has set us back to a Freudian era.
Interestingly, the liver cannot use ketones as an energy source.
The health transformations that are occurring in animals, it's jaw-dropping.
Those tofis, they're at the highest risk for serious diabetic complications.
If you are celiac, you need to be gluten-free. If you are not celiac, you don't need to be gluten-free.
Dietary protein needs what is basic and what is optimal.
Welcome to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast, where we meet the world's top experts to explore the secrets of health, mindset, longevity, and so much more. Are you ready to take charge of your existence and biohack your life? This show is for you. Please keep in mind, we're not dispensing medical advice and are not responsible for any outcomes you may experience from implementing the tactics lying herein. Are you ready? Let's do this. Welcome back to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast. Oh my goodness, friends, what a year it has been. I am so incredibly honored and grateful for everything that has happened with this show, with you guys in the audience, just all the things. And so this year I decided to do something extra special, which is to have a best of episode. I was inspired because I listened to Rich Roll's podcast and he always does a best of recap at the end of the year. And I love listening to those episodes. It gives me a little glimpse into some of the shows that I might have missed, into some of the highlights. And so I really think you guys will enjoy this. Let me know your thoughts and if you want me to keep doing it every single year. It was really hard to narrow it down. And there are so many incredible moments and guests beyond this, but hopefully there will be some nice insight from this brief recap. If you would like the actual episode numbers for each guest, check out the show notes. Those will be at melanieavalon.com/2022part1. Those show notes will have a full transcript, so definitely check that out. There will be two episode giveaways for this episode. One will be in my Facebook group, IF Biohackers, Intermittent Fasting plus Real Foods plus Life. Comment something you learned or something that resonated with you on the pinned post to enter to win something that I love. And then check out my Instagram. Also find the Friday announcement post. And again, comment to enter to win something that I love. If you are enjoying the show, it would mean the absolute world if you could write a brief review on Apple Podcasts. Honestly, it is the best way to support the show. So thank you so much in advance for that. All right, without further ado, please enjoy this fabulous best of 2022 part one episode for the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast. So to start off our first best of episode ever, we have Dr. Karen Becker. So Dr. Becker came about because I actually was researching developing a pet food line, and I was asking people for recommendations for vets, and everybody was saying that I had to read this book called The Forever Dog. I read The Forever Dog. Oh my goodness, friends, it was basically like David Sinclair's Lifespan meets pets. And she literally talks about all the things, like all the things we talk about on this show. She talks about it not only for the health of our pets, but for the health of us humans as well. It is mind-blowing. I was already suspicious about what we're feeding our pets today. And after reading her book, it's honestly just shocking. There is a major problem here with conventional pet food. And I can't even express how much I think she is revolutionizing the lives of our pets. Friends, I don't even have a dog. I don't even have a pet. And I love the book. I love this interview. And I can't wait for you guys to hear it. Hi, friends. Did you know that one of our largest sources of toxic exposure each and every day is through our skincare and makeup? It is so frightening the effects these compounds can have on our health. So we put these products on to help us look better, and yet they actually can be aging us, contributing to health issues, fertility issues, thyroid issues, mood issues, and ready for something potentially even more shocking? A lot of these endocrine disruptors are actually obesogens, meaning they cause your body to gain weight and make it harder to lose weight. That's right, your skincare and makeup may be hindering your weight loss goals. Europe has banned thousands of these compounds, and the US has banned around a dozen. There's even a loophole from the 1960s that allows companies to put whatever they want in their products, and they don't even have to tell you. That's why I am overwhelmingly careful about the skincare and makeup that I use. But here's the thing, it can be hard to find skincare and makeup that is non-toxic and actually works. And then on top of that, that actually has all the products you need. I have found two companies I am obsessed with their standards and use them every single day of my life and cannot recommend them enough. That's Counter, formerly known as Beauty Counter, and Crunchy. Both of these companies have incredible standards when it comes to what they put in their products. You can truly feel good about using them, and they actually work. For Counter products, go to melanieavalon.com/counter. And for Crunchy products, go to crunchy.com. That's crunchy.com/melanieavalon. New Crunchy customers can use the coupon code ADVOCATE10 to get 10% off. You'll also receive something special from me after your first order. I also highly recommend joining both of their loyalty programs. It's completely free to join, and with every purchase, you'll earn credit, as well as other fun goodies. For all the latest updates, new products, specials, deals, and fun things for me, because yes, I love giving things away, get on my email list. That's at melanieavalon.com/cleanbeauty. You can also get text updates when you text skincare to 877-861-8318. That's skincare to 877-861-8318. So again, to shop with me and get a free gift from me after your first order, go to melanieavalon.com/counter and also crunchy.com/melanieavalon. And new customers use the coupon code ADVOCATE10 at Crunchy to get 10% off site-wide. And again, definitely join their free loyalty programs to earn credit on every order. Hey friends, exciting news. My Avalon X Spirulina is back in stock and now at a reduced price. Plus you get free shipping and my coupon code works on top of that sale price. Spirulina is honestly one of the most nutrient-dense things that you can put in your body in a whole foods, easy to eat form. It's a blue-green algae, which is a complete vegan protein packed with an incredible array of nutrients. We are talking 100% of your daily hard-to-get vitamin K, 625% of vitamin B12, over 1,000% of vitamin A, 86% of chromium, 27% of vitamin B2, plus so much more, including iron, GLA, the powerful antioxidant superoxide dismutase, and even glutathione. In fact, spirulina is so uniquely nutritious that it was actually studied by NASA to support the astronauts. I searched high and low to find the very best spirulina out there. Ours comes from a wonderful, sustainable, clean, environmentally friendly production facility in Hawaii. Not Thailand, Hawaii. And then on top of that, we did our own third-party testing for over 70 pesticides, heavy metals, toxins, all the things. This is the cleanest spirulina out there. And with spirulina, you can simplify your supplement routine and support your nutrition in one easy step. The tablets are super versatile. You can swallow them whole, blend them into smoothies, crush them up, or honestly, just eat them like I do. And again, we were out of stock, but now Avalon X Spirulina is finally back in stock at a reduced price, and my coupon code MelanieAvalon works on top of that too. Plus, you get free shipping. Just go to avalonx.us/spirulina and use the coupon code MelanieAvalon to get 10% off our new reduced price plus free shipping. That's avalonx.us/spirulina with the coupon code MelanieAvalon. So here is Dr. Karen Becker.
Dom DeAgostino was very instrumental. We flew to Florida and interviewed him, but he was also instrumental in helping Keto Pet set up their protocols. And that's basically the protocol that we recommended in the Dog Cancer series. And out of that, so many people around the world have been able to contact us and let us know that their animals, since they learned about a species appropriate raw food diet or unadulterated diet, that there's been this overwhelming change in the vitality and the health and well-being of the other animals in their home. So just by getting the highly processed carbohydrates out of your dog and cat's diet, switching from an entirely dead overprocessed diet to an entirely fresh living food diet, the health transformations that are occurring in animals, it's shockingly jaw-dropping. And it's also so fun to watch, because when you and I decide to go from eating total cereal, that's the equivalent of dog food. So total cereal, it gives people 100% of synthetic vitamins and minerals that they need a day. And so does your dog food. It's a carb-based synthetic vitamin and mineral supplemented little pellet. That's what we're trying to sustain vitality and well-being with, is this little crunchy pellet with a multivitamin on it. common sense would say probably your animals need more than that. And you are correct. Animals need a whole lot more than that. But what's amazing is when you're like, okay, got it. I'm going to, at a pace that resonates with me, I'm not going to throw my kibble out right now. What I am going to do is start incorporating more living fresh foods. I'm going to use fresh food toppers. I'm going to ditch my crappy dog treats that cost a lot of money, and I'm going to switch to fresh foods. I've decided I'm going to give carrots and parsnip and celery. I'm going to give the bottom and the top of the green beans when I trim them off to my dog. I'm going to give the dented blueberries that all of the health and longevity researchers, but Dr. David Sinclair was the most profound in saying, never throw out dented blueberries. Those always go to the dogs because they have twice the polyphenols because they had to survive the dent, right? So all of those ways that we can very economically share safe and biologically appropriate human foods from our fridge with our dogs, every single bite of fresh living food that you put into your dog's mouth or bowl, replacing ultra processed, bad, cheap, carbohydrate-based, poorly made food, that is a step of health in the right direction. So you don't have to make it a, oh my gosh, I've been doing it wrong. I feel horrible. I've got to switch everything. Don't do that to yourself. But as you begin to incorporate one health strategy at a time, you see the results. Your dogs shed 50% less. The chronic ear infections go away. They become more muscular and lean, and they lose that kind of mid-tire belly fat. Their eyes are brighter. Their breath improves. They quit farting. That mucus on the stool and that intermittent belchy, farty, gassy, constipation, diarrhea, it all goes away. And it goes away because now they are having the raw materials, the nutrients, and this unadulterated fashion, meaning they're not heated, we're providing food up the food chain in its whole absorbable form. Dogs and cats do such a magnificent job of taking those nutrients from the real foods that we're giving them and absorbing them and assimilating them into their bodies in such fine fashion that you can literally, in 3 months' time, you can watch your animals transform before your eyes. And that's the inspiring piece that I want to give your listeners, that this doesn't have to be a race. You don't have to change your whole lifestyle. You can take little incremental steps that empower you to feel comfortable. You're like, okay, I did that. Woo, I'm feeling good about that. I'm going to do the next thing. As you improve the health and well-being of the animals in your life, you become empowered to do a little more and a little more because you see their results in front of you. And that's probably the best part for me, is that our animals' bodies show us what magnificent changes are doing. You can physically see it. And that's just so inspiring, especially as a health and wellness veterinarian, like brings tears to my eyes.
Up next, friends, we have somebody who is not only an incredible researcher, scientist, and author, but is just a sparkling human being. I love Rick Johnson. He is so kind, so knowledgeable. I was always listening to his episodes with Peter Attia, which were fascinating. So it was a true honor when he wanted to come on the show. And then on top of that, I've grown to know him personally, and he is just so amazing. And the work he is doing surrounding fructose is honestly revolutionary. He came on for his new book, Nature Wants Us to Be Fat, The Surprising Science Behind Why We Gain Weight and How We Can Prevent and Reverse It. It was a pretty mind-blowing conversation. So please enjoy this clip from my conversation with Rick Johnson.
So this is a big question, Melanie. Yeah, absolutely great question. So a long time ago, people were thinking that it was known for a long time that if you gave fructose to people, that triglycerides go up in the blood like 30 minutes later or 4 hours later. I'm sorry, it's 4 hours later. And the assumption was that those triglycerides were coming from the fructose itself, so that when the fructose is broken down, components of the breakdown products then get turned into fat. And there is some breakdown products of fructose that do go into fat, but it was a very small amount. It couldn't account for this big rise in triglyceride. So the really fantastic discovery was done by my partner, Miguel Lanaspa, and he was studying how fructose works. And what he found was that when you eat fructose, that there's this thing called oxidative stress that occurs. There's a burst of kind of this kind of chemically reactive oxygen that's produced in the liver cell. And that affects the mitochondria. And it's driven by the uric acid. Remember, we knew that the uric acid was involved. And that oxidative stress kind of stuns the mitochondria. And what it does is it sets up for fat production from precursors of fat that do not have to necessarily be from the fructose. So it sort of stimulates other, you know, glucose and other things present and fatty acids and so forth. It stimulates them to start making fat. So the fat doesn't actually come from the fructose. It comes from the other nutrients that are there. And so it turns out that fructose itself is sort of like glucose. It's just a sugar that it's a type of sugar, not table sugar, but a type of sugar in the global sense. And that, you know, it can be broken down to make energy and it can be turned into fat and glycogen. But fructose activates another process that tries to stimulate fat, not even from its own molecule, but from other things present. And it stimulates hunger, which makes you want to eat other foods. And it's not just sugar that you want to eat. It does cause craving of sugar, right? But it or sweet, but it also makes you eat more food, even if you can't really taste it. So this leptin resistance kicks in that makes you hungry. So fructose is a different beast. And we've kind of fell into the big mechanism by which it works. And it's sort of interesting because it's a nutrient. And so nutrients provide calories, and calories give us energy. And when we get energy, it's either an instant form of energy, what we call ATP, which is made, you know, largely by mitochondria and other mechanisms. And it makes stored energy, and stored energy is like fat or glycogen. And so whenever you eat, it's used to drive biologic act, you know, how we live and move and act and think. That's, you know, we need calories for that. And some of the calories are converted to instant energy, and some is converted to stored energy. And what fructose does is it creates an alarm signal because it drops the instant energy by, you know, 10 or 20%. And what it does is it tells the animal that there's some kind of alarm going on, that you don't have quite enough food. And so that's what seems to trigger food intake, fat accumulation, everything. It's like, uh-oh, I'm running low on my stores. And so it stimulates what one of my friends called an insurance plan. It's like fructose stimulates an insurance plan. It isn't really, it's triggered sort of by starvation, but it's not starvation. It's just a drop in the energy in the cell that makes the animal feel like it doesn't have enough fat stored away. So when that happens, it stimulates more fat storage. And it does that even though you already may have fat. So it tricks you. So you actually may have all this energy available. You have all this fat and glycogen that are stored energy, but when it drops the immediate energy, it tricks you into thinking that there's not enough energy around, so you make more fat. So it's a way to increase your fat. So all animals, all of us have some body fat. If we didn't have any body fat, we'd be really in trouble. But everybody has some body fat. And what this does is when you eat fructose, it wants to increase your body fat, no matter where you start. So if you're at 10% body fat, it wants to make it 15%. If you're at 15%, it wants to make you 20% and so forth. So fructose is an insurance plan aimed at increasing your fat stores, while glucose is kind of the immediate fuel. It's there to really make immediate energy that you can use right away. So the two sugars look very similar in composition. One's there to make immediate energy and one's there to make stored energy.
Up next, we definitely have a crowd favorite. When I've been polling you guys about your favorite episodes, so many people have said Dr. Gabrielle Lyon. Of course, Dr. Gabrielle Lyon is a woman after my own heart because she is all about the protein intake and she is so knowledgeable on the science of it. This was a thrilling conversation to have, and I think does such a service to so many people out there, especially women who may not be getting their adequate protein intake. I've also become friends with Dr. Gabrielle Lyon and can say that she's a pretty awesome human being. So please enjoy this clip from our conversation.
Is protein dependent on, are you saying that, is it dependent on body size or not?
Yeah, like total muscle or...
Yeah, okay. So let's break that down. The first thing that we have to think about is what is the total protein need of an individual? And protein is responsible for a multitude of factors, from hair, from skin, nails, protein turnover, which is the body's continuously breaking down and building up, which is essentially 250 to 300 grams a day of turnover in the body, which is different than dietary protein, but turnover is about 250 to 300 grams of protein. The body, as the body ages, the body becomes somewhat less efficient. Muscle becomes less efficient at sensing proteins. Just the body isn't as robust, which isn't a great word, but isn't quite as capable as it once was when we are younger and in growth. We have to understand that when we think about dietary protein needs, there's the difference between what is basic and what is optimal. In my mind, and the science would support, that 0.8 grams per kilogram is enough to prevent deficiency. Okay, so basically, if you're getting enough calories and you're getting 0.8 grams per kilogram, you're not going to be protein deficient. The average female, according to the NHANES data, gets about 75 grams of protein a day. The average male gets about 100 grams of protein a day. Now, let's think about what a great recommendation would be. And I would argue that while the recommendation is incredibly variable, right? So if you go and you look at the RDA, you could also then point out the AMDR, which is, you know, the average requirements, which are anywhere from, you know, 10% of the diet to 35% of the diet could be from protein, right? So that's not a great strategy because the percentage is so high. So if you were eating a 1,000-calorie diet and the range of protein is between 10 and 35%, on 1,000 calories, 10% of that is what? Like 100 calories from protein. So again, there's a huge disparity in the recommendations. And we have to account for that. One thing to understand is that a great starting place is 1 gram per pound ideal body weight. And people can titrate up or titrate down based on that. And it doesn't matter if you are male or female, if you are 150 pound female or 150 pound male, and that is your ideal body weight, then I definitely recommend 1 gram per pound ideal body weight. Now, let's talk about the next most important thing. So a 24-hour protein intake is really important. The next thing to consider would be, how are we going to distribute those calories? And how are we going to distribute those amino acids over the day? And there is one particular amino acid that one could make an argument for a meal distribution. And that is leucine. And what's so fascinating is that if you are sub-threshold in leucine, and I define that by the blood levels of leucine being low and not high enough to reach a threshold amount, a hyperamino acid level in the blood, which ultimately, for people who are interested, is 2.5 grams of leucine will increase the leucine level in the blood enough to then trigger muscle protein synthesis. And this is really essential for helping with health and longevity, okay? It's muscle is the organ of longevity. It's the most important factor, in my personal opinion. So after we determine the amount of protein an individual should eat, which I recommend is 1 gram per pound ideal body weight. And again, you can titrate up or titrate down. There isn't negative side effects with protein. But we then have to consider that it's actually the amino acids that we're eating for. And these amino acids, in particular leucine, require a threshold amount. And that translates to 30 to 50 grams of dietary protein per meal feeding. And you could eat 2 meals a day, or you could eat 3 meals a day if you're fasting, however you want to do it. But what becomes really important is you must reach that amino acid threshold. Because if you don't, you do not stimulate muscle protein synthesis. And over a period of time, if you do not stimulate muscle, you know, you will destroy it over a period of time.
Hey friends, I am about to tell you how to get 10% off the ideal coffee when it comes to supporting your health. So if you guys know me, you know I am obsessed with optimizing basically everything I consume, and that especially relates to coffee. Did you know that coffee is one of the most powerful sources of antioxidants in the modern diet? And yet, not all coffee is created equal. Between sourcing, farming practices, roasting, and contaminants, there can be a huge difference in the health impact of the coffee that you drink. That is exactly why I created Glow Coffee. Glow Coffee is a premium, specialty-grade Arabica coffee sourced from sustainable women-led farms in Colombia. It's organically grown, and we third-party test it meticulously, like every single lot, for purity. And what makes Glow especially exciting from a biohacking perspective is that we specifically made it to be rich in chlorogenic acid, or CGA. That's one of coffee's primary, most potent antioxidant compounds that has been studied for its role in metabolic health, inflammation, oxidative stress, and so much more. The elevation levels of the beans, how they're grown, and how they're roasted all affect CGA levels. So we searched high and low to find the perfect beans naturally high in CGA and tested them to confirm that, and then we roast those beans to preserve the CGA content. And then test after that as well. Coffee is already one of the potentially biggest contributors of antioxidants in the human diet, so I designed Glow Coffee to maximize those benefits while keeping it incredibly clean and high quality. And this coffee is so clean. It's grown organically, of course, but then we go even farther than that. We third-party test the beans for almost 100 toxic compounds, including pesticides, heavy metals, and mold. Oh, and perhaps the best part is it is absolutely delicious. We're talking smooth, low bitterness. It's honestly the exact coffee I personally want to drink every single day of my life. It's so bright, smooth, and delicious that it's also perfect black for fasting. No added sweeteners or cream needed. You can also splash it on your face for an antioxidant-rich toner. I do that every single day. After the sauna, after the shower, all the things. I created Glow Coffee because it's really about upgrading one of our most common daily habits into something that truly supports your health and performance. You can get 10% off with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at glowcoffeeco.com. That's 10% off Glow Coffee with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at glowcoffeeco.com. Are you ready to glow inside and out? Fuel your day, illuminate your way. That's glowcoffeeco.com. It is always a pleasure to bring on people of all different perspectives onto this show, so I really love when I bring on people who are really intense in the vegan world. Dr. Will Bolsiewicz is a legend in that sphere. His book, Fiber Fueled, is everywhere. I always see it at Target, for example. That's how you know you've made it. And what I love about Dr. B is I really appreciate his research, his nuance, his openness to meeting people where they're at, his what I perceive to be a lack of bias in his findings. So it was a pleasure to connect with him. And of course, we had to discuss the controversy of gluten and grains. Should we actually be eating gluten and grains after all? Check out this clip to find out.
Let me unpack gluten a little bit. So first of all, gluten is a protein. It's a protein that is found in wheat, barley, and rye. And if you have celiac disease and you consume gluten, it activates your immune system in an inflammatory way that is problematic. So in people with celiac disease, gluten is off the table. And all of these things that I'm talking about, like low and slow, reintroduce, it's about variety and abundance, that does not apply to a person who has celiac disease. If you were in my clinic and you have celiac, I would say you need to be gluten-free and you need to be gluten-free for the rest of your life. There's no bringing it back. But let's move beyond celiac disease. And by the way, I mentioned earlier that there's a big three of food sensitivity. And I said that constipation was one of the three. The second is celiac disease, so we're touching on it right now. And the third is gallbladder dysfunction, which is another thing that can cause food intolerances. And if you fix it, if you fix any of these three, people's food intolerances get way better. So now with celiac disease, it becomes imperative that you rule this out. And I want people to understand that a blood test is not adequate. The vast majority of people that I have diagnosed with celiac disease, they have a normal blood test. I was raised being taught, by raised, I mean in a healthcare system, being taught by the healthcare system in my medical education that these blood tests were really reliable for celiac. And it is not true. We misunderstood what is celiac disease. The reliable test for celiac is an upper endoscopy. You have to go down into their small intestine and take biopsies. And people have to be consuming gluten in order to do that properly. But let's assume that a person does not have celiac disease. Okay, so we're moving beyond that. They have heard that gluten is inflammatory and gluten is implicitly bad for the gut microbiome. But the problem is that, like, if you look at research studies, not in a test tube, which is, I think, a quite unnatural way to measure what I do and how I live. So rather than looking at a test tube or a rat study, let's look at like real humans eating a slice of bread. What happens? And what we see is that when people eat high quality sources of, like, for example, bread or like high quality carbohydrates that do include gluten, their microbiome becomes more healthy. Their inflammatory markers actually go down. And the reason why is because wheat actually contains a lot of prebiotic compounds that are good for our microbes. Flip side, like, we all know that wheat includes a very broad spectrum where it could be like high quality sourdough bread, but it could also be total junk food. And the vast majority of wheat-based calories in your supermarket are junk. I am not advocating for those in any way. Those are not healthy foods, but that's not exclusively because of gluten. They just happen to contain gluten and be unhealthy foods. So they did this study, Melanie, that I think you may have been leading me into a little bit, so I'm going to talk about it, where they looked at like people who have what's called a gluten intolerance. And what this means is that when they consume gluten, they feel unwell, like they have gas or bloating or cramping or abdominal pain or something like that. First of all, they verified that these people, they do not have celiac disease, okay? So celiac disease is off the table. And as I said, if you have celiac, you need to be gluten-free. And in this group that does not have celiac disease, they sent them home with 3 weeks worth of breakfast bars. And they said, mark down every single morning after breakfast how you feel, how many symptoms you're having. So the three bars were, first, the placebo. That's our baseline. We're going to compare to that. Number two, a gluten-containing bar. And number three, a bar that contains what are called fructans. Fructans are FODMAPs. So when they analyzed the results, it was a bit of a surprise. When people consumed the gluten-containing bar compared to the placebo, they actually had less symptoms when they were consuming gluten than they did when they consumed the placebo-containing bar. Placebo bar was more of a problem than gluten. When people consume the fructan-containing bar, they were triggered. The fructans, which coexist in wheat-containing products, are the reason that people get gas, bloating, discomfort when they eat wheat-containing foods, and that's because they are FODMAPs. But they're also prebiotic. They should not be thrown out. We should not be vilifying them. We should be looking at ways to overcome these limitations and restore function to our gut, make it stronger so that we can consume these foods. And that's kind of what you and I have been talking about for most of our conversation today. So the point is this. Here's how I see this. If you are celiac, you need to be gluten-free. If you are not celiac, you don't need to be gluten-free. But I do encourage you to buy organic if it's wheat, because most wheat is being sprayed with glyphosate unless it's organic. That actually can cause harm to your microbiome. Non-organic wheat being sprayed with glyphosate to me is problematic. I think that people need to make sure they're consuming whole grains. 98% of Americans are not getting the recommended amount of whole grains. And when you look at the evidence on whole grains, they reduce our risk of heart disease, our number one killer, reduce our risk of cancer, our number two killer, and people live longer when they consume more whole grains. I think we should be eating them. If it's not wheat, then it needs to be something else. So you don't have to be a wheat-consuming person. That's okay. But if you're going to go gluten-free, you need to make sure that you make an effort to replace the wheat, our number one whole grain, with something else. Quinoa, sorghum, teff, amaranth, brown rice. These are some examples of gluten-free whole grains that you could use as a substitute. So you don't have to consume gluten. You do need to consume whole grains, but the evidence on gluten is just a little bit more nuanced than what we've all been led to believe.
Okay, friends, now it is a true honor to bring you this excerpt from my conversation with Dr. Lori Mentz. She is doing revolutionary things when it comes to reframing how we view women and sex and women's pleasure with sex. So she came on to discuss her newest book, Becoming Clitorate, Why Orgasm Equality Matters and How to Get It. And if this is not evident by now, I am all about supporting women's orgasms, taking things into your own hands, and especially for the health benefits. And yes, I do still implement my nightly orgasm challenge. I actually don't think I've missed a night in... I actually don't remember the last time I missed a night. So that is a good train to be on. We talked about so many things, so definitely listen to the whole interview. But one of my particular favorite parts was some of the myths and hype surrounding the elusive G-spot.
Honestly, I think it was the media hype. And Betty Dodson, before she passed away, said the media hype around the G-spot has set us back to a Freudian era where we're all looking for some magic spot inside our vagina to make us orgasm. And it's not the scientific stuff around the G-spot. That's excellent. It's the media hype that this is like this great new discovery and you can find this. You can orgasm from intercourse. Your vagina has this capability. And that set us back, even back to that Freudian era where women were, quote, supposed to. It's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. You know, Freud said that once you're mature, you'll transfer your sensations from your clitoris to your vagina, which is like that's like saying when we grow up.
It makes no sense.
Right. We'll stop breathing out of our nose and we'll start breathing out of our ears. Like we don't change functions of organs, you know, and I think that has really done so much damage. And I think we started getting away from that where people in my era knew about the clitoris and that it's the source of women's pleasure. And then this G-spot hype, I think, set it back. Plus, again, you know, no progress on sex ed. We've actually gone backwards in some ways. So all of those things, I think, have set us back. And yeah, I do think, I mean, I think our genitals are just, there's so much to them that we don't know about still. But I do think that there is probably, I agree with that theory, I think there is probably an evolutionary factor for the G-spot, which isn't really a spot at all. It includes part of the vagina, part of the internal clitoris, and part of the urethra. But like you were saying, we know that if you push on it, for some people, it's pleasurable. For some, it's not. Some, it results in orgasm. But we know that pushing on it results in feeling less pain. And that is right where the baby's head comes through. And so it could have that evolutionary function that it's to decrease pain during childbirth. And we do also know, like you were saying, orgasms, when you have an orgasm from stimulating that area, your cervix pushes down, whereas if you have an orgasm from stimulating the clitoris, it pulls up, which gives more evidence that, maybe this was intended for evolution to make childbirth less painful. The vagina is a canal where babies can come out, penises can go in, dildos and fingers can go in, yet we call our entire genitals a vagina. And by doing this, we are linguistically erasing the part of ourselves that gives us the most pleasure, because we know that only 4 to 18% of us can orgasm from penetration alone. The rest need external clitoral stimulation. And so when we call our whole genitals a vagina, we're linguistically erasing the part that gives us the most pleasure, and we're calling our genitals by the part that gives our male partners the most pleasure, not the part that gives us the most pleasure. So everything isn't the clitoris, but the clitoris is the biggest part of our anatomy. It's a vast internal and external organ. The hood and the gland, the The hood and the glands are the only part that can be seen externally, but there's also legs and bulbs. And in fact, the G-spot, the real name for it is the clitoral urethral vaginal complex, because it includes part of the clitoris, part of the legs, part of the urethra, and part of the vaginal wall. But there is some thinking that maybe we could get away with, not get away with, but get away from this horrible hierarchy we have of vaginal orgasms are better than clitoral, if we called our whole unit, our whole genitals, instead of even vulva and vagina, if we had one name for the whole interconnected unit. And Helen O'Connell, who's the person who discovered the internal clitoris and made it public, says, "Why it's the biggest organ down there. Why don't we call the whole thing a clitoris?"
Hi, friends. Would you like to have the most epic eating experience? I'm talking eradicate bloating and better absorb your nutrients. If so, you need digestive enzymes. These are one of my most favorite supplements out of everything I take, and I truly cannot imagine my life without them. Digestive enzymes are key to break down your food into usable nutrition and to stop things like bloating, digestive distress, constipation, all the things. That's why I created Avalon X Digest. And you can get 10% off with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at avalonx.us. You can also get a subscription and save 15%, which you can pause or cancel at any time. Friends, I worked so hard to create the perfect blend of enzymes for Avalon X Digest. It's a full-spectrum, plant-based enzyme blend with proteases to help you break down protein, amylase for carbs, lipase for fats, cellulase for fiber, and so much more. In fact, there are 13 different types of enzymes in this blend. I cannot tell you how many people have told me that when they take Avalon X Digest, they experience no digestive distress with meals. These are truly game changers. And for any of you guys looking to up your protein intake, Avalon X Digest will help you actually break down and assimilate your protein so you get more protein from your meals. I wanted to create the highest potency enzymes so that you get all of these benefits when you eat with no problematic fillers or ingredients. Avalon X Digest is also tested multiple times for purity and potency, comes in glass bottles, and is truly the best enzymes on the market. And again, you can get 10% off with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at avalonx.us. Okay, friends, Bill Schindler, talk about a mind-blowing book, a mind-blowing interview. This is one of those interviews where you're just like, wow. Wow. So what I love about Bill Schindler is he doesn't talk so much about what to eat and not eat, but rather how to eat. So how have our cooking methods and our processing methods actually been the key part of our evolution in becoming human and related to why we experience so many health issues today? His book touches on so many fascinating topics: dairy, grains, meat, insect protein. And what I love about Bill is how passionate he is about everything that he's doing. I got so much incredible feedback from this episode. I knew it had to be included. So please enjoy this excerpt from my conversation with Bill Schindler for his book, Eat Like a Human: Nourishing Foods and Ancient Ways of Cooking to Revolutionize Your Health.
But we were doing a program with people, and we had something called, we were grinding grains, and we were using something called a cornstone. And a cornstone are these two round rocks that sit on top of one another, and you spin the top rock and you feed the grains into the middle, and it grinds it. So just keep that in mind for a minute. And so that happened the day before. So I reached up inside of this duck and I pulled everything out, and it's literally laying on my forearm. And I realized that the duck has a lot of things in its digestive tract that humans don't have, and they're designed specifically to process grains. So when a duck or other granivorous bird, a bird designed to eat grains, consumes grains. Now, remember, the first thing is they're not chopping them up. They're taking a raw grain right off the stalk or right off the ground, and they're swallowing it. A whole raw grain covered in lectins, phytic acid, anti-nutrients, all the things that we know grains have, and they swallow it. And the first place that it goes in their digestive tract is a crop or a crop-like part of their body, depending on the bird that they are. And what this is just an enlarged sort of pouch in their esophagus where the grains sit. Now, the grains will sit there for sometimes up to 14 to 16 hours in a warm, moist, dark environment. And during that time, a lot of things are happening. It's not just sitting there. They're absorbing water, they're swelling up, and they're soaking, they're fermenting. And sometimes, depending on the grain, how fresh it is, the length of time, and about all this, sometimes they're even sprouting. And anybody who's listening that knows all the great ways to deal with grains before we eat them, soaking, fermenting, and sprouting are incredibly important. So these soaked, fermented, sometimes sprouted grains, after they leave the crop, then go down into an organ called the gizzard. And if anybody who's butchered a chicken or taken apart a turkey for Thanksgiving dinner, that they know what the gizzard looks like. And the gizzard are two incredibly strong muscular discs that sit against one another. And the birds, they eat rocks. They're called gastroliths, little tiny rocks, gravel, that they consume on purpose that sits between these muscular discs. And these softened, detoxified grains go in between these discs, and they literally get stone ground. And what I saw in that was that gizzard was exactly what that cornstone was I was using the day before in County Mayo up in Bilderig. So these grains are detoxified, they're softened, they go down into a gizzard, they're stone ground, and then and only then do the grains go into the rest of their digestive tract, which operates in a very similar way to ours at that point. So I'm thinking, oh my gosh, other than baking, actually heating the grains, these birds are making sourdough bread inside of their bodies. And I'm like, wow, that's amazing. So that really kicked off a lot of my thoughts about detoxifying grains and thinking about sourdough bread and all that sort of thing. But at the moment, I also had this thought. I said, I wonder if, and looking at their digestive tract, I wonder if we took a grain and bypassed those two, the crop and the gizzard, and stuck that grain, you know, into their digestive tract a little bit lower, what it would do. Because that's essentially what we're doing when we're eating grains that are right. What would it do? And I said, oh, I'll never that's a question I'll never get answered. Well, about 3 or 4 years ago, it did get answered. I came upon a disease, a malnourishment issue that ducks and geese get that live in city parks, that get fed by the really nice old people that are sitting on the bench and feeding them bread. They get a disease called angel wing disease. It's because they're malnourished and not getting the nourishment that they need. And here are these, just think about how crazy this is. Here are these birds, granivorous birds that are designed to eat grains, that are getting fed grains in the form of bread from nice old people sitting on a park bench, and they're getting sick and they're getting deformed because of the malnourishment in this. And what's happening is that the grains that are in that bread, just regular sliced pan, loaf, you know, Wonder Bread kind of baked bread, that hasn't been through that, they can't go through that process, right? Even though it goes into the crop and the gizzard, it doesn't get done what needs to be done because it's already been processed, it's already been cooked, and they're getting sick. And that's exactly what is happening to humans when we're eating bread that hasn't been processed the right way. But the good news is we can replicate what happens inside of those birds outside of our bodies. When we make real traditional, wild, slow fermented sourdough bread, it is a completely different food than even the most high quality, yeasted, all grain, you know, whatever kind of bread.
Okay, friends, time for a legend of a guest. Especially if you listen to my other show, the Intermittent Fasting Podcast, you're probably familiar with the fabulous Dom D'Agostino. He is the go-to researcher on all things ketones and the keto diet. So having him on the show was the highest of honors. I got to ask him all of my nitty-gritty questions regarding ketones and ketosis. It was honestly a dream. So enjoy this excerpt from our conversation.
Well, biochemically, what happens is you are, the simplest way to explain it is that when you enter a state of ketosis, whether it be fasting ketosis or the ketogenic diet, the beta oxidation of fats are so high in the liver, you accumulate acetyl-CoA. And the accumulation of acetyl-CoA gets directed into the path of ketogenesis, where two acetyl-CoA molecules will condense enzymatically to what's called acetoacetate, and that's a ketone body. And then through another enzyme, the acetoacetate can convert to beta-hydroxybutyrate, which is another ketone. And then they both enter circulation, and in the blood, it's in about a 3 to 1 or 4 to 1 ratio, beta-hydroxybutyrate to acetoacetate. But the reason that happens, that your body makes ketones, is it's, well, to preserve energy flow to the brain. That's probably the evolutionary reason why. But biochemically, what happens is that the level of beta oxidation of fatty acids in the liver is so high, you got to do something with the acetyl-CoA, and the Krebs cycle gets a bit backed up. And the acetyl-CoA then gets condensed and forms, goes down the ketogenesis path. And that's almost entirely dependent upon the suppression of the hormone insulin. So if you were to get even just a little bit of sugar or anything that increases insulin, insulin's a storage hormone, and you go quickly from a catabolic state, fat catabolic state primarily, to an anabolic state. And so if you're fasting, for example, and you're in a high state of ketosis and you inject the hormone insulin, it kind of can cause a dangerous scenario where your ketones will start to come down after a period of time. You'd probably be protected from the hypoglycemia, and that has been shown in some early work. But that production of ketones is primarily a result of the lowering of the hormone insulin, and that stimulates your fat burning so much. So ketones are a really good indicator that you are burning fat. So in that case, you know, Atkins was right. Like, you know, you get your ketones elevated and you know your body is in a fat burning state. You can't make ketones without burning excess fat. That's a statement that no metabolic physiologist would argue with.
So to clarify, so the acetyl-CoA building up in the liver is coming from fat stores on our body or our diet?
Yes. Yep. When we fast or we go into a state of ketosis, whether it be diet or fasting, then you're getting fatty acids to the liver, you know, through your adipose. You activate, for example, if your sympathetic nervous system is activated, it can activate hormone-sensitive lipase, and then the adipose tissue or like cells that contain the fat, right? And then you're liberating the fatty acids, the triglycerides and fatty acids from your system. And these fats go in circulation, and the fats are an amazing source of fuel for skeletal muscle. The heart preferentially burns fat for energy. The liver, you know, relies on fat for energy. Many organ systems do. But the long-chain fatty acids that are typically dietary and the fats that are stored in adipose do not readily cross the blood-brain barrier. So what happens is that these long-chain fats are broken down through a process called beta oxidation and to their constituent molecule, which ultimately is acetyl-CoA. And then the acetyl-CoA is a breakdown product of fat, which is occurring at a very high rate in the liver. The liver is chock full of mitochondria, and there's just like massive fat oxidation in the liver. Interestingly, the liver cannot use ketones as an energy source. So the ketones that are produced in the liver get spilled into circulation, and then they become fuel, most importantly for the central nervous system, but also the heart.
Up next, friends, we have a guest I was particularly excited to interview because he is somebody that I have been following for years. Ever since I really started getting interested in health, Chris Masterjohn was one of the go-to guys. I would read his blogs, read the forums of people talking about his work. So it was an incredible honor when Rob Wolf introduced me to him. And Chris Masterjohn is honestly one of the smartest people I have ever met. And I was also a little bit overwhelmed about interviewing him because I was like, there's so many things I could talk to him about. Definitely check out the episode because we covered so many topics. It's like a grab bag of fun things. So here is just one of them, which is the reasoning and logic of the RDAs for vitamins. And it might not be what you think.
Okay, let me go back to your first question before I answer that, because your first question was about amounts. So the RDAs, so there's the National Academy of Medicine, which used to be, until recently, was the Institute of Medicine. Their Food and Nutrition Board sets the dietary reference intakes, or DRIs. And within the DRIs, there are minimal amounts and upper limits and various other values that feed into them. And so the most popular of those is the one that people pay the most attention to is the RDA, which is the recommended dietary allowance. And then when there's not enough evidence to make an RDA, there is an AI or an adequate intake. And then there also are tolerable upper intake levels, which usually people, if they refer to them at all, just call them the upper limit. Those are set for some nutrients and not others, just based on whether there's any known toxicity. And then very recently, just with the salt and potassium guidelines, they came out with a new one, which is, don't know if I remember it right. I think it's the chronic, it's something like the chronic disease reduction requirement. I'm messing it up, but it's one that's aimed at not preventing a deficiency disease, but rather reducing the risk of a chronic disease. And so then when people look at the values on a food package, usually those are the daily values that are set by the FDA. They are not set by the National Academy of Medicine, and they are not part of the group of DRIs that I was just talking about. But they usually are derived in some way from the DRIs set by the National Academy of Medicine. But actually, there are sometimes some very significant discrepancies. So like for the longest time, the daily value, and they were recently revised, but for like most of our lives, the daily values were actually using like old DRIs from significantly longer ago. And so you would see, for example, that like the daily value for biotin was like 10 times higher, according to the FDA, than the adequate intake set by the Institute of Medicine. There are definite discrepancies with what you'll find on a food label for these, but like dietitians will usually utilize the DRIs. Food tracking apps will often, they may be using the daily values or the DRIs, you would have to look. And then if you Google like what's the RDA for something or what's the upper limit for something, you're generally going to find the DRIs. Okay. So the RDA, when there's an RDA set for a nutrient, is set on the assumption that the amounts, and this is where I'm getting to the answer to your question about variation. The RDA assumes that there's variation in the amount that different people need of a nutrient. And the RDA is not meant to be used by an individual to say you need to consume this amount. Rather, the RDA is basically set for a population. And first, what they do is they calculate an estimated average requirement, or EAR, for a population. And then they try to make the RDA cover 97.5% of the needs of that population. And generally, like, so what they usually, this involves like assumptions rather than data. So, and that's because usually they have no idea what the variation in the need for a nutrient in the population is. So, like, the standard thing that they do is they say, we have no idea what the variation in the need for this nutrient is. So we will assume that it is normally distributed, which means that it takes the shape of an ideal bell curve. And we will assume that, you know, if you have data that takes the shape of an ideal bell curve, two standard deviations covers, you know, would move you, like if you take the mean and you go up two standard deviations, you'll arrive at the 97.5% coverage point. So you have 2.5% of the area that bell curve is left out. So they assume that there's a bell curve of some variation. They say, we have no idea what that variation is, but we'll assume that a standard deviation is 10%. And so we will cover the need for 97.5% of the population by taking the estimated average requirement and multiplying it by 1.2. In other words, adding the two standard deviations of 10%, so adding 20% to it to cover the needs of 97.5% of the people. Now, one of the problems with this approach is that anytime they ever do have any data on the variation in the need for this nutrient, it's way higher than 10%. So like there's never been a nutrient where they've measured the variation and the needs for the nutrient in the population and arrived at something as small as 10%. But they, you know, for a very long time when the DRIs were being set, the person who was like the chair of the committee over like actually probably the majority of the DRIs that are set was at that time very concerned that if you set the RDAs too high, everyone would go out and be supplementing. And then then we'd wind up with like a mass vitamin toxicity problem. Under this concern, they systematically erred on the side of setting the DRIs to be, in the absence of knowing exactly where they should be, on the lower end of where they thought they might turn out.
Hi, friends. Out of all of the incredible biohacking devices that I use to optimize my health and wellness, there is one type of biohacking device that I have been using the longest. We are talking every single day of my life because it radically changes my life that much. It helps my energy levels, my sleep, my anxiety, so many things. You might know what it is. It is the category of blue light blocking glasses. I just found an upgraded form of this, which does so much more than just block blue light. There's a company called Hyperlight Optics. They've been established in Europe for years and are just now coming to the US. And here's what makes their glasses so special. You might have heard me talk about C60 on the show before. Hyperlight Optics actually uses patented Swiss technology with fullerene C60 as a quantum light transformer. Basically, they transform bad light into healthy, beneficial light. As light passes through the lenses, the fullerene actually twists at a near inconceivable 18 billion times per second, altering photon orientation. So this takes problematic wavelengths of light that we're exposed to in our modern environment and transforms it into healthy light. They are the ultimate ideal form of blue light blocking glasses. And they come in the coolest styles ever. These are truly luxury glasses. They are such high quality. I have never found blue light blocking glasses like this before. They're truly right up there with all those fancy name brands people are tempted to buy. Prepare yourself to get a lot of compliments. Plus, unlike normal blue light blocking glasses, which you might just wear at night, you can wear these all the time. In the morning, the afternoon, the evening, inside, outside. You can turn every moment that you look at the world into a therapeutic experience for your eyes. They're great to use at the computer. They'll reduce your eye strain, headaches, fatigue. You can wear them at night to regulate your circadian rhythm, especially if you're looking at devices, and you will sleep so much better. And did I mention they have so many styles and look so cool? By the way, if you want the model that you've probably seen me wearing a lot on social media, those are the Eclipse Blue model. And like I said, they are new to the US, and I have one of the only discount codes available. You can get 10% off one pair of Hyperlight, 15% off two pairs, and 15% off all future purchases once you buy one pair with the coupon code Melanie10 at hyperlightoptics.com/Melanie. That's right, 10% off one pair, 15% off two or more pairs, and 15% off all future purchases with the coupon code Melanie10, M-E-L-A-N-I-E 10, at hyperlightoptics.com/Melanie. Up next, we have one of those interviews where I heard this guest on Joe Rogan and was immediately like, can I please book this person? Dr. Anna Lemke is doing fascinating research on the nature of addiction, the neurotransmitters in our brain that are involved, what addiction actually is. And one thing I love about her book is it's a really nice blend of the science and also really interesting personal stories about her experiences with many of her patients, including some pretty shocking ones. And even Dr. Lemke talks about her own addiction with romance novels. In particular, I was really excited to talk to her about my own perceptions of my addictions. Like, for example, do I have work addiction? Is that actually a bad thing? We talked about so many things, and I definitely recommend her New York Times bestseller, Dopamine Nation, Finding Balance in the Age of Indulgence.
So yeah, so habit versus addiction. So habit, you know, describes a behavior that we do that is outside of conscious awareness, right? That we can start doing that thing without even really realizing that we're doing it, whether it's biting our nails, picking our nose, sucking our thumb, whatever it is. And in many ways, habits are really useful because it's a very an energy efficient way of engaging in motor activities without the cognitive load of having to think about doing it. Like, you know, tying my shoes is a habit. I no longer have to think about, you know, making the bunny ears and having the bunny go down the hole or whatever. But so habit in and of itself, you know, is not a bad thing, although we can have bad habits. Addiction sort of encompasses habit and yet is more than that. So there's certainly a level of automaticity in, in most of our addictions, where we start doing the thing before we even realize that we're doing it. But addiction is beyond habit, and it's negative, almost always negative. I think of addiction, you know, as conceptually as a maladaptive form of coping that encompasses habit. So I think that there's CBD is kind of a tough example because, you know, the science to date suggests that it actually doesn't have much impact on the brain, even though, you know, it is FDA approved for this rare form of epilepsy. And even though a lot of people swear by it, the controlled studies suggest it's really no different from placebo or a sugar pill. On the other hand, placebos are powerful. Even when people know they're taking a placebo, if they were told that it helped other people, they will have benefit from it, even when they know it's a placebo. So I guess what you're asking in a way is something like, if you believe that what you're doing releases dopamine, you know, is that the same thing as releasing dopamine? And I don't know the answer to that question.
That was what I was wondering. Going back to the solution here, I feel like there's two big camps that are here. And one of them you talk about at length in the book. So something like complete abstinence, so like AA for Alcoholics Anonymous, for example, compared to a camp of more, you know, moderation. How do you feel about those two different approaches? And is it that some people just really do require complete abstinence forever? Can some people moderate? Like, what does the recovery pathway look like, especially in regards to abstinence?
Whether your goal is abstinence or your goal is moderation, the place to start is a period of abstinence long enough to allow those neuroadaptation gremlins to hop off the pain side of the balance so that baseline homeostasis can be restored. So when patients come in to me and they say, you know, ultimately I'd like to use this substance or behavior like quote unquote normal people, I say, okay, I can help you with that. I can try to help you with that. But first you have to abstain for 30 days because otherwise you're not going to reset reward pathways. It is much harder to go from using a lot to using in moderation than it is to go from using a lot to using none to going into moderation. So it always begins with this period of abstinence. And again, I argue that the neuroscience supports that path. Then, you know, in terms of, you know, after that month of abstinence and resetting reward pathways, you know, who should continue to abstain and who can use in moderation, I don't even have the ability to predict that, right? You might think based on past experience, you know, that I could predict that, but I've really given up trying to make those types of predictions. And I just really try to help patients do the experiments to figure out for themselves. What I can tell you is that if you're going to try moderation, then it's very important to be very specific about what the goal of moderation is. We have data for alcohol, but we don't really have data for anything else. So it just comes down to, well, what sounds like moderation to you? Moderation usually means not daily use. It usually means not binge use. And people are pretty good at sort of like thinking about, okay, well, I think I want to, you know, smoke this many days, you know, in a week or a month under these conditions with this type of substance, or play this many video games under these conditions with this type of video game, or whatever it is. And I talk a lot in the book about various self-binding strategies, because I think it's an important point when we're talking about abstinence versus moderation, that there are frankly certain drugs that it's impossible to abstain from. If you're addicted to food, you can't just stop eating. If you're addicted to digital devices, for most people, their work requires them to be on devices to be able to do their jobs. So then the discussion of moderation becomes a universal one, where we then all need to think about, okay, how can I, you know, manage my consumption of this thing that I essentially must consume in the modern world or for my survival?
All right, friends, what better way to close this show than with a guest that has been one of my most popular to date, talking about one of the most popular topics that I talk about, which is intermittent fasting. Megan Ramos is a legend in the fasting world. She works with Dr. Jason Fung and co-authored the New York Times bestseller, Life in the Fasting Lane, How to Make Intermittent Fasting a Lifestyle and Reap the Benefits of Weight Loss and Better Health. Megan is such a beautiful, sweet, kind soul and so knowledgeable on fasting and especially its practical implementation for people doing it. She works in the clinic. She works with these people. She's a wealth of knowledge, and I definitely really appreciate her support of fasting and females specifically. So to end this best of episode part one, please enjoy this excerpt from my conversation with Megan Ramos.
Type of movie, and that's called your abdominal cavity. And then there's this space between your abdominal cavity and sort of your skin that, you know, covers your belly. And subcutaneous fat primarily lives outside of that shield between the skin and the shield. So it's separated from your organs by this shield, by the abdominal cavity. So it's, you know, it's not able to infiltrate them and cause issues with them. It just kind of sits there. And this is, you know, the fat that we don't necessarily like when we're at the beach and we're trying to wear a bikini or trying to fit into a tiny dress or a nice suit. You know, we don't like this fat because it's what society has, you know, typically labeled as, you know, unsexy. And we associate this type of fat to be the fat that comes with disease. And well, yes, you could accumulate it and put enough strain on the body. It can lead to disease and to problems. But what's actually more dangerous is the visceral fat, not the subcutaneous fat. So the visceral fat, that's the fat that's, you know, is underneath that abdominal cavity, meaning that it can infiltrate inside your organs and wrap around your glands and your organs. And it's like putting headphones on your organs because it prevents them from being able to hear signals that are being sent from other organs and other glands to do certain functions in the body. Or it will just so infiltrate them with fat that they're unable to function properly. So something that we all very commonly hear about these days is non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And when you have an ultrasound done or a CT scan done that diagnoses this, you'll see phrases like mild, moderate, and severe fatty liver infiltration. So that's just how much of the liver, the gland, has been infiltrated, you know, by fat. And we'll see things like this happen with pancreatic function. So we'll actually see tons of fatty pancreases now on CT scans and ultrasounds. And that was just really wild because I've been looking at these results since I was 15. Never. And then when I was like 26, 27, I started to see these coming up on ultrasound and CT scan results. And then I saw a fatty spleen once. And I'm like, what the heck is a fatty spleen? And I'm calling radiology. Like, there's like a typo here. I'm like, this is a big typo. And it's not. So you get this infiltration, and then that really disrupts organ and gland functioning and communication. That leads to a lot of disease and causes a ton of inflammation in the body as a result. So this is really scary. And these people are usually walking around thinking that they could afford to eat an extra cheeseburger because they don't have a lot of the subcutaneous fat. So they're what we call thin on the outside, fat on the inside. We hear from these people all of the time, you know, we're type 2 diabetic, we're not type 1, but we don't understand. Jason and I, we had this one patient came in. She was very petite. She was like 4'10" and she was like 88, 89 pounds, but she was all fat. And she was, you know, by body composition standards, she was morbidly obese. So, the idea was not to make her 50 pounds. And when I was 97 pounds, it was not to make me 50 pounds, but it's to make sure that you've got a healthy body composition by shifting the ratios around, less fat and more lean mass, more bone and muscle mass. And that's why, you know, at 120 pounds, I'm a size 2 and I'm less obese than I was at 97 pounds. And I wore a bigger size at 97 pounds because I had more fat mass. So it's, you know, body composition and body fat's kind of a finicky thing. So sometimes genetics plays a role in where you gain this fat. Sometimes you'll see, you know, families where everybody's very slender, but they will have type 2 diabetes and metabolic syndrome. You'll see families that are all, you know, very perhaps overweight because they have a lot of subcutaneous fat, but they don't have heart disease. They don't have type 2 diabetes. And then you're really kind of unfortunate fortunate if you get a mixture of both the visceral and the subcutaneous fat, because, you know, people with that visible fat, they really feel awful about themselves because society has just set us up, you know, to feel that we must fit a perfect box all of the time. So there's these different types of fat and they can sort of manifest in different ways, but it's actually those tofis that they're at the highest risk for serious cardiovascular complications, serious diabetic complications. So they're the ones that really need to focus on adjusting their body composition the most.
Okay, friends, I really hope you enjoyed this best of recap episode. Again, if you would like to visit the full episode for each guest, check out the show notes. They will have links to each individual episode so you can check that out. Let me know what you thought of this. If you'd like me to continue doing it every year, join me in my Facebook group. That's a great place to connect with me. Also, let me know what your favorite guests were from the year and stay tuned for part two next week. And of course, have a fabulous New Year's Eve and 2023. Thank you so much for listening to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast. For more information, you can check out my book, What When Wine, Lose Weight and Feel Great with Paleo Style Meals, Intermittent Fasting, and Wine, as well as my blog, MelanieAvalon.com. Feel free to contact me at podcast@MelanieAvalon.com. And always remember, you got this.